Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
It is Tuesday, May 12th, 2020, in the year of the tweet. Pretty weak tweet there, Truman. So it's the year of the tweet and of the global pandemic. I don't know, do we get a crowd screaming sound?
How's that?
Right. So with us this morning in the Gene Bosch studio in bustling and bodacious while the rest of us, except for Susan, are lounging comfortably at home in our PJs, zooming into the show as our master of the virtual mix and Zoom modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien. Truman, good to have you here this morning.
Good morning. Thanks. I'm trying to. Susan is. We hear her, but she can't hear us. So she's scrambling around trying to get a headset here that works. So we'll see if we can.
It may be an advantage if she can't
hear. Yeah, there could be. It could very well be. Could very well be. But she's working on it. So I'm hoping that we're going to get her.
Okay, all Susan. The headsets are turned up, and I can't hear a thing.
You can't hear a thing?
Oh.
Well, I'll be darned. I wonder why.
This is live radio.
Radio, here we are. We can hear you, Susan.
Well, good. I'm not going to say anything because I don't know what I'm answering.
Well, what the
heck? But we could call on you and repeat the question or something, couldn't
we?
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. Tell you what, Susan, why don't you, let's see. Why don't you try that headset over there?
All right.
Molly's headset.
Let me continue on while this.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They're all turned up.
We'll work it out. Go ahead. Go ahead. Talk amongst yourselves. We'll work it out.
So, out of the land of magnolias and social distancing in her home on the island of Madronas comes the analytic academic social worker, poet, backup singer, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes, Lynn Kerrigan.
Good morning, everybody. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, Lynn. Providing insightful feminist critiques of the action of our reigning Big Chief Little Hands and host of Voice of Vachon's Real Talk, which follows the Briefly by 15 minutes, is Susan McCabe, who is also in the studio with Truman this morning. Susan, who do we have to look forward to you interviewing today on Voice of Vachon's Real Talk?
Today is going to be really interesting. I have two guests. One is Alita Haskins, and she is married to a guest I'm going to have by phone from the Stafford Creek Correctional Center. He's Lawrence Jenkins, currently incarcerated. And we're going to talk about Senate Bill 6164, the governor just signed into law, which allows prosecutorial discretion in resentencing hearings and what that means to a real person.
Fantastic. Interesting times for people in incarceration with COVID-19. So good. Looking forward to that, Susan. So highly visible on our Zoom screens and also by telephone this morning is the Phantom Editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly online newsletter for your consideration, Kevin Jones. Kevin, what's the next big thing on Indivisible Vachon's calendar?
Well, good morning, everybody. And Bruce, I am glad that you asked. On next Wednesday, the 20th of May, we have our monthly meeting, and we're excited to have poet Myrna Hecht joining us. If you haven't tuned into Myrna's latest project of poetry from immigrants and their images and their drawings, you'll be able to hear Myrna summarize what she was able to accomplish and the messages from many of these young people who are dealing with this amazing situation of a global pandemic and fleeing violence in their home countries. So I hope people will be able to join us. And you have to register. So email me at kevin@indivisiblevashon.org, and I will make sure you get an email invitation.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. So do you want to say that website again?
That is an email address. So you can email me at kevin@indivisiblevashon.org if you would like to get an invitation to register for our meeting on May 20th with Myrna Hecht.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Myrna is also working with the Communicare section of Vashon Be Prepared, helping to collect poems, prayers, spiritual sort of writings about how people are dealing with the COVID-19 sort of pandemic. And Lynn, you're doing that as well. You're working with some
writers. Working on a little prose. Yeah, just, you know, as people are writing diary kind of entries, so they might not be uplifting. They might be gritty and unhappy, or they might be sketches and not really fully formed literature. So it's just sort of another avenue for doing it. And I'll fold that into the history project or the library project for collection later.
Great. What Lynn's referring to there is we're trying to collect all kinds of things related to this pandemic in a Vashon COVID-19 archive project, Voice of Vashon, Vashon Be Prepared, Vashon Library, and Vashon Heritage Museum, all working together to make sure that we keep a record of what we're all living through right now. And of course, my name is Bruce Hallman. I'm a historian. Today is my job is to sort of herd this group of intellectual cats, if you will.
Good luck.
And it's very good luck, as always.
As a historian,
I try to provide a long-range view and constantly reminding folks that the grinding wheels of justice, which we have a sound effect for the grinding wheels of justice. There they are, grinding wheels of justice. They may take time, but they eventually get the masters.
There they are. That's a better one.
There we go.
I hear those wheels grinding. Speaking of the grinding wheels of justice, what do you all make about of Attorney General William Barr's dropping the charges against Michael Flynn?
Can you spell distraction?
I don't know. It just absolutely blows me away. I mean, I'm beyond words, really. I don't know what to say about it. It's just a mind-boggling that he can do that.
It's terrifying to me in that it is yet another example of the destruction of our system of checks and balances. The Supreme Court is going to hear the case of Trump's tax returns. I don't have a lot of hope for that. And now Barr is dropping the charges against Michael Flynn in order to distract and perhaps remove the notion of there having been any problem with the 2016 election in Russia. He's campaigning. Trump is campaigning again, as always.
Oh, and more than that, I mean, did you hear the his press conference where he got really angry and left when he was saying, boy, it's coming. You know, just wait. You're gonna be hearing what's it's going to become. He's going after Obama's record. I don't know what. He won't say what it is, but he's got the dirt, whatever it is. It's Obama more distraction. Obamagate. Yeah. There you go.
Obamagate? I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah. No. That's what he's calling it. And he said, it's coming, boy. Just very soon you're going to get all the dirt, whatever it is.
And what was that word you mentioned, Susan?
Distraction?
That's it.
Yes.
Got it.
It's really shocking to me to see how pervasive the administration has been able to corrupt and alter our course of checks and balances. Mm-hmm. You know, I know this has not just happened just recently, that some of the groundwork for all of this has been laid for a long time. But I find it astounding that, you know, Barr, as the Attorney General, can now interpret law totally for the administration if he wants to, and that we are under even more duress with the Supreme Court. You know, we want Ruth Bader Ginsburg to stay healthy, because to me, if the Supreme Court falls any further than it has with people who are loyalists to one particular man and administration, then we have become a banana republic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned, Susan, the Supreme Court hearings. So those are ongoing. I think they may now actually be completed. I listened earlier this morning, and the theme that was notable in the hearing that I listened to was how these subpoenas become so overwhelming that it impedes the ability of the president to perform their basic duties.
If only he were doing that anyway.
Well, you make a good point, Lynn. The thought that came to me is that all that means is that if you haven't committed enough crimes for the subpoenas to slow you down, you ought to commit more so that the subpoenas become burdensome, and then they have to basically stand down on all of them. So, I am not optimistic either. I'm hopeful, Susan, that the Supreme Court decides that Congress should indeed have its congressionally mandated oversight of the president. And I think I don't know how long it'll take us to find out, but I don't think we're going to find out today or tomorrow. I think it'll be a while.
Pretty scary.
So you don't think we're going to learn anything today then, Kevin? You think they're just having the arguments and then they'll make some decisions in the next few days?
I don't know, but I believe that's the sort of standard protocol for the court, is to have the arguments. I did notice that there was a, I didn't catch it, but there was a post analysis of the hearing that was apparently multiple scholars were able to voice their assessment, which usually means interpreting these things for the lay person like us.
Right.
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to listen to that today.
I think there's another issue in front of the Supreme Court today, in addition to the release of the tax records, which it has to do with, can a sitting president be prosecuted? So there's two issues before the Supreme Court right now, and I don't know how they're going to do the order of that. Did you hear anything about that part of it, Kevin, the schedule or the, you know, stay tuned for?
Yeah, immediately after the hearing on whether these subpoenas were enforceable, and these were directed at Deutsche Bank and the other firm that is Trump.
Mazars.
Thank you. And then I think the other case was the Vance case, if I remember the word right, and that was like immediately following. So I believe that's probably now done.
Oh, wow.
But the testimony, I suspect, is now complete on that as well.
And then there was a third case being heard today, which was about a Washington state, what they call unfaithful electors.
Oh, right.
Sort of the idea of whether an elector can actually change their vote. The idea is an elector is supposed to vote the way the state vote. This is in the Electoral College.
Now,
the Washington state electors was what they call, what the term is, unfaithful. In other words, voted differently than the state.
Mm-hmm. State. And but now superdelegates are not bound by that. Is that correct?
No, this is in the Electoral College.
No, I understand, so, but I thought we have delegates and we have superdelegates, I thought, to the
in
Electoral
the convention.
College. Is that only in the convention?
That's
Am I getting
convention,
confused?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm getting confused.
This is the Electoral College for presidential
right.
elections.
Yeah. I know the Electoral College. I just thought, okay, never mind.
There are lots of moving
Truman
parts.
Brain fart.
Yeah, sorry.
Some people may think they're superdelegates, but really
yeah.
Right.
I just sent a note off to ask to see if there were any reports.
One other comment. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, I just had one other comment on the Michael Flynn case, and probably those following the details have heard this, but the idea that in a plea deal, which is where the process he was undergoing, there are numerous other charges that have been dropped for his confession and his cooperation to reveal the truth. And now that he's apparently backed out of that, it leaves us in a quandary about all of those other violations that he was accused of, and where does the wheels of justice stand on that? And my guess is that nothing's going to happen until January of 2021, when we get a new administration and they can actually get a new Justice Department who cares about the rule of law and maybe looks into Flynn again.
Sure.
I think the thing that I want to say about this argument in these cases before the Supreme Court was how interesting I thought it was that the arguments turned on interpretation. You know, so they're basically saying now that some of these accusations against Trump shouldn't be valid, shouldn't be seen as legitimate because their basis was not for like to get his tax returns, wasn't for a legislative purpose, but to get him out of office.
Yeah.
And so it polarizes and it makes, you know, everything in the rule of law related to this kind of political. They're just picking apart the law such that, you know, it reveals to me some of the challenges of the rule of law. We tend to want to think of it as kind of cut and dry, and if it's this way, one thing happens and another, it can go the other way. But really, it has to do with the ability of various attorneys to frame and phrase, you know, these arguments such that it casts doubt in people's minds about, you know, the legitimacy of the law as it stands or as the interpretation. And I just found that amazing that they're able to say, you know, none of these charges are legitimate. They were all political to get him out of office. And I just want to say my last thing. I keep wanting to scream at somebody. If he would stop doing illegal and unethical things, I would quit wanting him out of office.
Good point.
Go ahead, Kev.
You know, and Lynn, those arguments definitely came out in the hearing today. I believe it was Mr. Letter, who was the attorney representing the U.S. House of Representatives, made a very clear and compelling argument that the reason that the Congress needs these records is to be able to determine whether or not the existing law of the land is adequate to be able to, effectively guard against improprieties. And so getting information that may illustrate improprieties that our laws may not be adequate to protect against is a very valid request. Now, of course, the White House attorneys pushed back on that and claimed that it was just as you say, it's just a try to get after the president and get him out of office.
Okay, so I'm reading the Washington Post analysis of the arguments, and it says basically that the court's conservative majority seem far more critical of demands for three congressional committees for the records and questioned whether approving the subpoenas would open the door for a Congress rule by one political party to make potentially harassing requests of a president from a different party. What Congress proposes as a limiting principle that the request must be tied to potential legislation is really no protection at all, says Samuel Alito. So I think that's exactly what you're saying, Kevin, that they're trying to make sure that this doesn't get politicized. But
huh.
Yeah, exactly. Ha is right.
I don't even know what to say. You know, I mean, it does get so deep. You know, what should we call it? The quicksand gets so deep.
It is the nature of the rule of law. And I think Obama, in his comments a couple days ago was correct about how all of these things are an attack on the concept of the rule of law.
Right.
And laws are difficult to write so that they're ironclad. Laws are always open to interpretation. And so it'll be interesting to see, even the strict constructionists on the court, like Alito, I think are going to have a hard time, you know, finding that Congress doesn't have a role in overseeing the executive branch. If they do, we're in serious trouble.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of blows the whole idea apart, the separation and checks and balances. And
exactly.
So
there goes our democracy. Poof.
There was
what would be the recourse then?
Oh, yeah, we don't have. I mean, the 25th Amendment, maybe, I don't know. But
couple recourses. Constitutional amendments are one recourse. Constitutional convention to rewrite the Constitution is another. And that's fraught with all kinds of you know, ups and downs, upsides and downsides. But those are really the two kinds of recourses from a Supreme Court decision. Certainly legislation, Congress could pass legislation, but it would go through another kind of hearing process. But so, those are really the only three ways that I know that you can redress this kind of thing.
I just want to tell you, one of the comments that from Kerry Dunn, who's the general counsel for the New York County District Attorney, said that one of the reasons these records are needed is for an ongoing criminal investigation that touches more people than Trump, and that the federal courts already have decided that the request would put no additional burdens on the president. So that's their argument, separate from the president.
And they
made a really good point that, you know, these subpoenas are against private institutions, right? Mazars, Deutsche Bank, et cetera, and that they're not burdening Trump at all. Of course, the counter to that is, well, you know, if your business was getting subpoenaed, you'd probably be paying attention to it. So, in fact, there is a burden. But, you know, the point that they tried to make, or the line of questioning, I don't know if it was a point they're trying to make, but the line of questioning was, at what point does the burden get too immense, and therefore it's unjustified to proceed with the subpoenas? And I hope they make the case that, yeah, it's not Trump himself, it's not the White House, it's entirely separate financial institutions that have to bear the burden here.
And aren't those but not businesses such... with which he was supposed to divest himself, or from which he was supposed to divest himself, which would say to me, his business is being president of the United States. The rest of it should have been divested and be somebody else's problem at this point.
Well, isn't that a perfect example of the emoluments clause, which could have been made way more clear, you know, because the first thing that was said about him that I remember was his refusal, you know, to divest. And he just turned over his running operations day to day to his kids. But on the other hand, he's still benefiting from anybody that is walking in those doors. And right. Nobody even knows what the word emoluments means. And so, you know, he's been successfully able to sidestep that very clear statement in the Constitution that says presidents, you know, cannot accept gifts from foreign leaders or, you know, anyone. And so I could see the emoluments clause being rewritten, you know, just as a clarification. I can see that. But the arguments that are so specious just frost my hide, or I'm mixing my metaphors. Well, because there was there was one argument that they used that said the outcome is going to be bad for the president, and so it can't go forth.
Oh,
I couldn't believe that,
boo-hoo.
And I just thought, yeah, duh.
Yeah.
Well, one thing we were talking about timing. This article says that the timing of the hearings means that the High Court's rulings will probably land this summer, right in the midst of the 2020 campaign. So that'll be very interesting.
So if we can shift gears here just a little bit. Susan, you were speaking the other day about separation of powers. And the New York Times, in a recent article about sexual harassment charges against Joe Biden and the Me Too movement and the reactions of women politicians, suggests that the charge has pushed the Me Too movement and the politicians who support it, like Mr. Biden himself, into uncomfortable territory. How do you separate, or can you separate, support for Me Too and support for Joe Biden?
I don't think that's necessary, honestly. I think the fact that Joe Biden asked for a record of the complaint that was made in, I believe it was 1993, is a good start, a good step in the right direction. As a feminist, that satisfies my curiosity for the moment. I would like to know exactly what was recorded and how what the complaint was. And the timing is incredibly convenient, in my view. Why did this woman, Tara Reid is her name, why did she come forward now and not sooner, particularly since Biden's been in the race for quite some time? So I want to listen to survivors. I want to listen to women. I want to hear what they have to say. But, you know, women can be just as corrupt as men. And I'm probably going to get shot for saying that.
No, you won't. I think that we have to understand that nothing is either all 100% correct or 100% wrong. That, as we talked about with the rule of law, it's very nuanced and particular. You know, it really has to be teased out separately. So I think everybody is entitled to, and I share your opinion, Susan, that I think these are kind of fraught political times with a lot of allegations flying around and not much time to find the actual facts that is being tried in the media, as I said last week.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate thing, is that these kinds of harassment situations or sexual assault situations are he said, she said. There is no way to really identify facts about this kind of thing. Maybe the best thing would be for Biden and Reid to meet and discuss it as individuals. Maybe that would satisfy the Me Too folks. But it is hard on progressive women. I don't see Republican women out there wringing their hands over Trump's bragging about his sexual assaults. Nobody in the Republican Party is saying it matters. No, it doesn't matter to them. But the Democrats have been very self-righteous about this, as we should be. And it's a quandary. But I think it can be handled in a way that recognizes both the Me Too movement and Joe Biden. The truth.
Well, one of the things that I find difficult about all of this is the idea of, you know, we had a long sexist past, you know, where the patriarchy ruled and men of all stripes and persuasions, you know, some went along with whatever strange, you know, manipulations of women was happening, and some tried to stay out of it. But I guess, you know, over time we've evolved, and we are now trying to, you know, grade our past according to the values of the present. And I think that's always a very tricky thing. And in fact, I'm just going to give you a quote that I read yesterday. I picked up Winston Churchill's 6-volume history of World War II to start reading, because he's such a fabulous writer. And there was a quote in there, not related to this, but something similar, that said, if we use the present to compare the past, we lose the future.
Hmm. Good point.
Which I thought was really interesting, that it's a locked-in battle that's not very easily won on those terms, that we may not be asking the right questions. And Susan, I think when you say maybe they could meet and talk about it, then you get to, are there real interpersonal, you know, difficulties that could be solved between two people, or apologies or reparations or whatever, versus a political moment in the sun.
I agree. In the sun, in the media. Well put. And I have to say, this has been an evolutionary process, the whole Me Too thing. I grew up in the world of advertising and entertainment as my professional career, where sexual harassment was de rigueur. And what you learned was the castrating retort to protect yourself. Nobody really took your side or even considered that sort of thing out of line And then as the world progressed and I became a manager of writers in a large corporation, the question of sexual harassment suddenly came up. And there was a sexual harassment training, the prevention thereof, in the corporate world. But they figured when they did the training courses, then they were done. So it has evolved. It continues to evolve. And here we are at another evolution opportunity, if you will.
Kevin.
Hey, I'll just, Lynn, you're picking up six-volume set of Churchill's History of World War II. If our listener hasn't read it, it is phenomenal. The other phenomenal tome to read, it's fairly lengthy but totally consuming, is William Manchester's The Last Lion, which is, again, a three-volume set.
Oh, that's the new one.
Of which, I don't know when it came out.
It's recent because it's about Churchill, right? It's the new one about Churchill.
It is about Churchill, but it took long enough to write that Manchester actually passed away before the third volume of the three-volume set came out. But his co-author completed it. It's a fascinating look at a fascinating life and a leader, although challenging to have in times of peace, was essential to have in times of war. The Me Too movement, I know I'm diverging here, so I'll get back on task, but I would hope that the essential element there is that women are not cast aside and ignored when they raise facts, data, concerns about past violations, and that it's not a matter of those accused are banned from whatever pursuit they're trying to be part of, but that the charges are fairly heard, investigated in a way that is fair and equitable, and that decisions get made that fully recognize that these are difficult assertions to make, particularly against men who are in powerful positions. So I would hope that fairness and equity attend this. But I certainly think that, you know, just all of a sudden Joe Biden is bad, when the real question is, how does Joe Biden stack up against Donald Trump and his 25 or 27 accusers, I think it was the record.
I've lost count.
I think that's a perspective that people need to consider in this case, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, I couldn't agree more, Kevin. I really want fair hearing of any accusation. But it is true, the question or the definition of sexual harassment has changed over the years too, has evolved. And like I said, what I lived with as normal is now considered sexual harassment. Well, bravo, I'm glad.
So I'm a retired airline pilot, right? And as an airline captain, I can tell you a lot about how things have changed and are changing for the good. One of the things that happened very early in my career was this thing called crew resource management, CRM. And what that had to do with was listening. You know, the captains used to be, they were God, boy. I mean, anything they said went. And then we discovered that there were some accidents that happened that was a very bad thing, that there were other people who were putting in information that was valued, and that we needed to value those voices. And so I've told this story many times, but one of the absolute finest captains that I ever had the opportunity to fly with was a woman named Christy Gomez. And Christy was not only an incredible pilot, I mean, she flew aerobatics in her off time, but she ran, I flew her there in the 727, which is a three-person crew, and she ran the crew beautifully. I mean, you felt confident and competent and valued your whole time. And I learned a heck of a lot from her, and she was instrumental in getting some of the CRM started. And in fact, the CRM at first it was only pilots. And we, by the way, Alaska Airlines has a lot of women pilots. Always has, always have had. But the CRM was just for pilots. And then they discovered, you know what, we need to bring the flight attendants into this as well. And so they did. And then we, our CRM classes, which you had to do every year, was a combination of the pilots and flight attendants. And it was very eye-opening. Some of the things that were disturbing to flight attendants that pilots were like, what? You know, we had no idea. But anyway, it's all evolving, and it's a great thing. Kevin, go ahead.
And in the operating room as well, understand. I don't know where it started first, Truman, whether the operating room or the cockpit or some other place. But yeah, the voices that participate in the operation of any system are valued and bring context that just one person can never have alone. So I think it's a tremendous approach.
Yeah. Okay. At the risk of stating the obvious, I just want to say the role of women has been really tough for centuries, particularly in Western society. Well, everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And just in Western?
Right, right. But
sorry.
It's getting better all the time, and I'm glad to see that. But I'm also pained a great deal when I see some of the injustices and the cruelties that are still visited upon women throughout the world in ways that men never have to think about. Enough of that.
That's right.
Okay.
Next? What's the next subject, Bruce?
Yeah, I was gonna say, next, Bruce?
But we've all been living under lockdown for over a month now, almost 6 weeks. And of course, the governor has just recently, Governor Inslee has recently laid out a four-step program to sort of bring things back online. What's your reaction to that? Do you think Washington State is moving in a sort of smart way? Or are we moving too quickly, too slowly? What's sort of your reaction?
I think we have to do it. I mean, I just read recently where some of the scientists are saying before this thing is over, we're going to have 70% of the populations will have been infected. 70%. That is huge. But at the same time, I mean, we've got to get stuff going again, however we can do it. I think we're doing it in a very smart way here. I think Governor Inslee has done a great job toward that end.
I've always been thinking about it, about what a dilemma we're in the sense of, you know, we have this unknown coronavirus that we're learning more scary things about every day. And we did kind of, in my experience, a very unprecedented thing to shut down, you know, entire countries, not just a city like Wuhan, China, but entire countries so that, you know, they could slow the effect of so many people getting sick at one time. And I think that, you know, the virus, at least we have scientists. So I listen to the scientists about how they, you know, think that the virus is what we're learning about it, what we need to do in response to it. So I personally want to be pretty careful. But I think with the idea of shutting down the entire country and how you prevent us from bankrupting the entire country and causing, you know, long-term problems that were the sort of secondary effect of the virus. I think we don't have much learning about how to do that well. And it's trial and error, it sounds like, in different parts of the country. And some of it is working and some of it is not. Me, I just think I want to be able to play outside again without that being part of a lockdown. That makes no sense to me.
I think you can play outside safely now. Yeah. But I've been doing that. So far, so good.
Yeah, I've got something to say about that, but go ahead, Kevin.
With family members, and there's others. Couple things. Tim Kaine, actually, in the hearings today that include Dr. Fauci, made I think a quite an impressive point that in South Korea, where they sort of, U.S. and South Korea had the first case about the same time. South Korea has a 4% unemployment today, and the United States has a 14% unemployment, and that number is probably understated and probably going to go up. And the idea that, yes, there's certainly, it's a missed opportunity and now spilt milk, perhaps, that the United States didn't take the actions like South Korea did to really contain this. To the four-phased approach, I read it a fair amount of detail this morning. I think it's well thought out. And the one thing that I think is missing in all the detail that's there is the specifics of what are the criteria we need to meet in terms of specific numbers to move from current phase one to phase two. And I'm sure that the governor's office probably has that information, but it wasn't apparent in the stuff that was online that I read. But I think that the progression is probably makes a lot of good sense. They have probably 30 different parameters that they'll be looking at, and in terms of responsiveness, contact tracers, PPE, hospital bed capacity, things like that. So my guess is it's a start and see how it goes. The last point I'll make is, you know, there's some counties in the state. If you go out to the governor's website and you can find the dashboard, there's some counties in the state that have zero deaths and zero cases. So that may just be that they haven't tested.
Yeah.
But, you know, counties that don't have the coronavirus have a chance still to keep it from spreading. So it seems to me that counties in that situation should be able to move forward, but with care, just like South Korea moved forward and was able to manage their spread of the disease and protect their economy. So hopefully we'll find a mix that'll work.
Did I send all of you the article by Aaron Bromage?
Yes.
Yeah, I did send that to you.
Yes, you did.
I think that is absolutely one of the best descriptive tomes of what the...
Can you summarize it for our listener?
Boy, I'm going to try. I was thinking about trying that. What basically he's saying is, it's a matter of...
with exposure.
No, it's a he.
Okay.
It's a he. It's a combination of time of exposure and kind of exposure. And so the time is the big element.
Yeah.
That if you're in an outside area where there's lots of airflow and whatever, your time, you can exceed your time a little bit because there's enough airflow that you're not going to get the number of particles that are required to infect you. But if you're in an enclosed space for a long period of time, you're in big trouble because you have more exposure and the exposure is more prevalent. So anyway,
it's more concentrated. That was well done, Truman, I must say.
Well, very well done. But if our listener wants to go out and look this up, Aaron Bromage, Bromage, and I would look up that article. It is absolutely fascinating.
It's a sort of it's a concept of that I've heard talked about as virus loading.
Yeah. You
know, that, yes. Right.
The amount of virus that you're exposed to. You know, if you're in an enclosed hospital room where you're aspirating somebody and they're spewing things out in the air, you're breathing it in. It's very concentrated. If you're out in a park and somebody walks by and they're, you know, 10 feet away, yeah, it's possible, but the possibility is very, very minimal.
Yeah, he talks about the choir where we had the 65 members of the choir and singing, exactly. Of course, you're putting out a tremendous amount of air and you're putting that virus into the air in an enclosed space. So, you know,
my sense in part is, and we're almost out of time here, is that the governor has laid out a very rational sort of process of bringing things back online. I'm impressed with the fact that he's doing it not one sort of set model for every place in the state that it's variable based on where you are in the state and what the situation is. And like you said, Kevin, what I saw lacking in it was those hard science, sort of scientific guidelines. You know, when you meet this and meet this and meet these criteria, then you move to the next step. And I suspect those are there. I mean, the governor and the county and the city of Seattle have all been working with the epidemiologists, and I think have taken a very scientific-based sort of approach to this pandemic. And it seems to be working.
I'm going to say goodbye because...